We're going to get the State Government Finance Committee meeting underway here. Representative Detmer, will you move the minutes for April 8th?
We got extra chairs today.
Madam Chair, I so move the minutes.
Representative Detmer moves the minutes for April 8th, 2015. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
Thank you.
The minutes for April 8th, 2015 are adopted. Members, we're going to take up the two Cresha bills first. Representative Cresha, if you want to come to the table. We'll start with House File 1190. Members, please take a look at those, that bill in your packet. And we'll have Representative Howe move House File 1190.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'll move 1190 to be heard by in front of the committee and be laid over for possible inclusion.
Yep. Okay. Representative Cresha, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Howe, for moving my bill. I'm sure it will come out in all the things that we do together. I'll get you back. I'll buy you a nice dinner. Members, what you have in front of you is, of the two bills I have today, this will be the most challenging to get through. This will be the toughest bill. And so, boy, it is early, isn't it? This is a bill up in Camp Ripley, and I have with me a testifier, Jeff Thielen, who's in charge of that. What we're doing in Camp Ripley is we have a great resource. It's a military museum, and many items from around the state are sent to the military museum with the expectation that they'll be archived, cataloged, and ready for public showing. The problem with that expectation is there's no funding for it, and it's very difficult, and we have a big influx of getting materials through. And if you've ever been there, it's absolutely wonderful. You see the letters from spouses, and you see the letters from soldiers of all the different wars, and it really gives you a flavor of what the sacrifices our families have had to endure for our freedom. And so I'm going to turn this over to Jeff, and I'm going to let him talk a little bit about it, and I hope that you'll consider how important this archiving is to our area. So go ahead, Jeff.
Welcome, Mr. Thielen. If you can please state your name for the record and who you represent.
I'm Jeff Thielen, and I'm the Executive Director of the Military Historical Society of Minnesota, and the primary outreach effort of that organization is the Minnesota Military Museum at Camp Ripley. And I want to thank Representative Cresha. He has a very good understanding. He's been to the museum many times, and I think there's probably a few faces in here that have also been to the museum a number of times. We're at Camp Ripley, and the first thing I always like to get across is we are a nonprofit organization. We get a lot of support from the National Guard and from Camp Ripley. Everybody should have a handout that was provided in your packet. If not, I brought extra just to make sure. And it covers some of the basic facts from the museum. We do receive a pass-through appropriation that's also approved by this committee, and that's in the governor's recommendation this year was $100,000, which is what it's been for quite a few years, and that's in House File 1864. Two years ago for the biennium, I came to testify at this same committee and talked about our need for an archivist, and the need for an archivist is huge because we had what we called a black hole that was our archives, and it was just a lot of stuff in boxes and some stuff that volunteers had put together in file cabinets. But for the most part, we didn't know what we had, and we had a lot of records from the Civil War, a lot of stuff that came up from the Adjutant General's office and never made it to the Historical Society. So we had all this stuff, and we had to do something with it, and saw the need, and was fortunate to receive an extra $120,000. I've cut back our request a little bit. I should probably increase it, but I've cut it back because we bought some of the equipment we needed, and I'm basically looking for salary funding for the archivist for the 2 years, and that's in the form of $100,000. I want to tell you about some of the things that we found that we do have up there. We have a lot of significant historical records, and this is in your fact sheet from Civil War, Spanish-American War, Mexican Border Wars, and if you want to check this out, please do so. We have an archival website now complete with finding aids because of this archivist, and so everything that is in our archives, pretty much everything that he's processed so far, is online so that people from around the state and around the country can do research and check and see what we have. So you can check that out right now if you'd like. One of the things, we're working on a number of partnerships, and I've listed one. I'm meeting with the Dean of the Library at St. Cloud State when I leave here because we have a 15,000-volume library that I also want to open to the public, and I'm working on Dean Vargas from St. Cloud State to on a federal grant that we're trying to achieve to make that happen. One of the things we did do, we probably have the largest collection of county honor rolls in the state. I think we have over 40 different county honor rolls, and if you've never seen these or heard of these, it's like a high school annual, but it contains all the pictures and information from each county of their members that were in World War I. So St. Cloud State is digitizing those now as we speak, and those will all be online and available for public use. I won't go through all the stuff. You can read the fact sheet. I've asked the archivist point blank, what do you have left to do? And he says there's two years worth of processing left. And I said, okay, we'll try to find the funding. I realize that the legislature probably won't do this forever, and my ultimate goal is to have this position funded probably in a three-way partnership between Military Affairs, the Historical Society, and our organization, the Military Historical Society of Minnesota. So that's the ultimate goal, and I've told Representative Kreshaw that, you know, we're probably not going to be looking for legislative support for this in the future unless there's a huge windfall and it would deem that we could support it. We've got 15,000 photographs that our archivist is just starting to process. He's processing some film, state emergency records, strike records from the Guard involvement in the Hormel strike, different things like that. If you look at our staffing on the back, I'm half-time. We've got a half-time curator, a half-time assistant curator. Our first full-time employee was the archivist. And we've got some of the best volunteers in the state of Minnesota, and we're always looking for new volunteers. So we've got some great things on the agenda up there, and one of the things I said we'd like to open our library to the public and get those books into the system, and at least for researchers across the state of Minnesota and across the country, so I want to digitize that collection and put that online. We've got a site visit from the Air Force, so we're looking at becoming an Air Force museum, which means that all the people that are living around Camp Ripley and have C-130s doing touch and go constantly at the airfield would have the opportunity to come and visit a C-130 on the ground, because the only way I can get a C-130 on the ground is to become an Air Force museum. So that would be the start of our Air Force equipment. And one of the things that we've started to look at is a mobile museum for the state of Minnesota that would be available to schools and legions and VFWs, that would be a smaller version of the Minnesota Military Museum that could go out on the road, because, you know, we've got some great exhibits, and, you know, our numbers are 15,000, you know, roughly 15,000 a year. They've been falling a little bit, as with all museums. So I guess the philosophy is if they won't come to us, we'll go to them and bring what we have to the people. And I'd like to invite everybody to the 50th anniversary of Vietnam exhibit, July 18th, which is our grand opening celebration and opening of the event. That event will probably run for 5 years. And we'll be opening a Women in the Military exhibit, a new updated version, actually by May 1st. We've put a rush on that. So if you've never been to the Military Museum, I'd offer to give you a private tour. And Madam Chairman and members of the committee, I hope you can look favorably on this bill.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Thielen. Is there anyone from the public that wishes to testify to this bill? Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Kreshaw, for bringing this to the committee here. And I know, personally, I spent several weekends and weeks up at Camp Ripley, and also the Gold Star families. They have their retreats up there now. They've outgrown another facility. And make sure you put something in your museum about the famous wood tick. So that's something that we've dealt with up there, too. But thank you for bringing this to the committee.
Thank you.
Representative Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I will echo some of those. I will say that if you have not been to that museum, it is an eye-opener for most folks to actually walk through there and look at all the artifacts and all the activity that our Minnesotans have been involved in and since the start of this great country. So I would urge you to go up there and see all the different things that are there and all the information that's available to us.
Representative Kahn.
This one, Madam Chairman, was a big shock to me to walk in and see that the uniform, something looked identical to the uniform that my father came home in from World War II, is now considered a historical artifact. I think we wore various parts of it to paint the house and things like that.
And Madam Chair.
Representative Kreisha.
And Representative Conner, it's a big shock that you did not stop in for coffee when you went by my house to go to the museum.
It was very long ago, Ms. Representative Kreisha. I'm afraid I didn't know who you who you were at that time.
Representative Carlson.
Yeah, not related to the request, but I was curious because it's been a while since I've been up there on a legislative tour. What's the status of the facility?
Mr. Thielen.
Representative Carlson, the status as far as...
Building?
I mean, the actual museum facility?
Yeah.
We're in a 19... I believe the building that we're currently housed in is a 1934 building. That was a regimental headquarters at the time. It's a concrete structure. We have... Actually, back when I was a company commander of an engineer company, we put an addition, a steel addition on that building. We have a number of outbuildings. At some point, we have a 30-year plan with Camp Ripley on what we can do with the facility we're in right now. I know that there are plenty of people in the state of Minnesota that would love to see a larger building built, a bigger facility. That's our biggest problem right now is space. We have more as any small museum, we have more artifacts stored than we could ever possibly display. And the reason that I actually asked the board at our last board meeting if we should have a metro substation of the museum, because we have so much stuff, and it's just a matter of putting it together. And aside from that, the best thing I could come up with is a mobile museum at the time to at least get that material and equipment out and let the public see it, and especially in the schools. We have probably 60 school tours a year, and they'll be starting in about 2 weeks.
Representative.
I'm sure I remember the reason I was asking that question when we did a tour with the Capital Investment Committee a while back. The best way to describe the facilities was that you were very cramped. And
yes.
What you've just described apparently is still continuing problem with space. There was also some issues when we talked about the artifacts and so on at the time about climate control. And has any of that been resolved? Because when you're dealing with artifacts, you have to make sure that they're in safekeeping, so to speak.
We don't have the facilities that the Minnesota Historical Society has. We have one climate controlled building that the bulk, or actually two that are connected, that the bulk of our very precious artifacts are in, but we have a number of buildings that are storing artifacts that are not climate controlled and HVAC controlled, no.
Representative Carlson?
Yeah, well, ma'am, I just wanted to point out that there, in addition to the request here, that there are some needs that still are in need of upgrading, I guess, would be the best way of putting it. I suspect the Capital Investment Committee will probably have to tour the facility again to kind of see what their current status is. But thank you.
Thank you,
Representative
Carlson.
Pugh.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Mr. Thielen, is it, for your really compelling testimony. I have not been to the museum, and I look forward to getting there as soon as possible. In fact, I'll look forward to marking my calendar for both of those dates that you shared.
Great.
I love your idea of the mobile museum. I think it's awesome. The thought came to mind about how wonderful the Zoomobile is, as it brings the zoo, the Minnesota Zoo, to schools throughout Minnesota, and how I've participated in a number of those events in my district, and how excited the kids are, many of whom have never been to the zoo. And I know that it then in turn inspires their families to actually go visit the zoo. And I think the same thing would happen with your museum. So I absolutely love that idea. Madam Chair, I have one question.
Sure.
If I could. I'm interested to know if the museum has done any outreach to Minnesotans wondering if they have any artifacts that they maybe have in their homes or in their families and would be interested in donating if they knew about your museum. I can't help but think that there are, you know, thousands of Minnesota families that have no idea that you're even there. So I'm curious about that.
Mr. Thielen.
Representative, the largest battle we have is making people aware that we're out there, and we do have a website, and you can pull it up. There's a couple pages on the website on how to donate artifacts, and both archival and artifact material. And you know, everybody's halftime. It's a group of volunteers and halftime people aside from this archivist. So, you know, we've got some of the greatest volunteers in the world, and people that are putting in 20 hours a week volunteering, and you know, they work harder than a lot of employees. So it's when people have a passion for something, it's really amazing what they can do. Mm-hmm. But what I can do is I can make an appeal. When you make an appeal like that, you have to have the staff that can handle the input that would come in. Mm-hmm. And that's a difficult piece right there. But you know, I do news releases constantly, and I can do a news release that would invite that. And from my past life, I have some friends still in the media, in the metro media, that might be willing to cover a story like that, which would generate an awful lot of information. Mm-hmm. So I'd be willing to work on that. Yes.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you. I'll look forward to visiting further about this when I come up for a visit.
I'll give you a personal tour.
Thank you.
And Representative Detmer, last.
Yeah, thank you, and maybe this is some information for the committee and also for Camp Ripley, is that in 2016, Minnesota has been accepted to host the 2016 Medal of Honor Convention here in the Twin Cities. And we have only one living Medal of Honor recipient that's still alive from Minnesota. He lives in California. That's Leo Thornes.
Okay.
And he'll probably be here in Minnesota. So in 2016, that will be the Twin Cities will be the location for the Medal of Honor Convention. So that's something that you might want to look into.
Representative Detmer, I'll do some research and try to work some type of a program in there, yes.
And Madam Chair.
Representative Detmer.
You can contact me because I have the point of contacts for the convention committee. So thank you.
Thank you.
And Representative Carisha, I assume the coffee pot is always on when we come up and tour the facility?
Scones for you, Madam Chair.
Sounds good. All right, members, with that, with no further questions, we're going to lay this over for possible inclusion in the state government finance bill. Thank you, Representative Carisha.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Second bill, House File 1261. Representative Detmer will move House File 1261.
Madam Chair, I move House File 1261.
And Representative Carisha, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, members, the rulemaking bill that you have in front of you, House File 1261, requires agencies to address laws governing the rulemaking process. Currently, an agency doesn't have to submit any evidence that there's substantial economic impact to a business or local government. This bill addresses those concerns by requiring an agency to determine whether there is a substantial economic impact for a new proposed rules. Substantial economic impact for new rules will allow for certainty to private sector businesses as well as local governments and as defined by the following criteria. And those criteria are by qualifying the impact to a private sector economy in an amount of $5 million or more in a single year, if the new rule increases the costs or prices to businesses or local governments, has an adverse impact to Minnesota businesses, or the cost of compliance in the first year of the rule is $25,000 for any one business with less than 50 employees, or affects a local government with less than 10 employees. And I'm going to stop right here for just a second and give you a couple things to remember. If you remember nothing else, remember the fact that many of our cities and our counties are contacting us as legislators saying, wait a minute, where did this come from? And now we have to respond to that. That's really what the impetus of what you have in front of you is. Those of us that have heard those concerns from counties, have heard it from our constituents, this is our ability just to put an opportunity in for us to stop and say, wait a second, is this the legislative intent that came out? If the agency determines the proposed rule has a substantial economic impact, it must send the proposed rule to the legislative auditor. The legislative auditor will then convene a 5-member panel to review the proposed rule. The panel must address the following criteria. If the proposed rule is based on sound, reasonable, available scientific, technical, economic, or other information or rationale, and if the proposed rule is more restrictive than a standard limitation or requirement imposed by federal law or a rule in the same subject matter. I'll give you a quick example of where this will come into play and how we should look at this. through this bill I have, or through this committee, I have another bill that's come through. It's the Sentinel Landscape Bill. You're going to hear that on the House floor. The legislative intent behind that is simply to set up a Sentinel Landscape for the ACUB program. As Representative Nash sent out, we shoot big guns, we make a lot of noise. Our area is to create a buffer. Now, that has to go through rulemaking, and we're going to ask a group of people to look at that and create some rules. If, when they look at that, if they grab something from the federal government that they have to implement that is beyond the intent of what we try to do, I should have the ability as a legislator to call a timeout and say, wait a second, this is not what we asked for. This is not eminent domain. This does not affect the waterways. This does not affect all the things that may come into play. So I'm giving you a good example of why my bill now is important. Because if that gets going and it gets off the rails, so to speak, with the intent that we put into place, we should be able to say, wait a minute, let's review this one more time to see what changed. And I'm going to put that in front of you again. Let's review rules to ask the question, what changed? Because a lot of times things happen, things change, and we create uncertainty. The other thing that I'm going to make a case for on my bill is perhaps you saw this small fiscal note that came through. I read through it. It started off well. The plot turned quickly, and there was a twist that I didn't expect. And that twist is suddenly the agencies are making this huge case that if we take away this ability, there's this large amount of cost. But one of the things I think this fiscal note actually points to is the problem we have. And that is, at one point in here, we have DHS claims that there may be an estimated 100 petitions based a year on the 85 bulletins issued. Now, let me point this out for you. If suddenly what they're telling us is there's this huge problem out there, then my bill is exactly what we should do. We should be solving that problem. So on one hand, they're pointing to us and saying, yes, there is this huge problem. We should be we're going to have to review all these rules. And my answer to that is, yes, we should. So that's one thing. The second thing is, the PCA determined under here the long-term fiscal considerations that there could be third-party litigation or federal law or rules that won't be able to be implemented. Nothing in this act prevents us from implementing federal law. That just simply is not the case. The last thing is, it's interesting to note that agencies claim that the cost substantial economic impact will be a burden when the statement of need and reasonableness requires them to estimate the probable cost. They already have to do that in the statement of need. So essentially, as I read this, they're saying, we're going to have to do more work that we're already doing. So I'm trying to be as objective as I can to look at this, but at the side of me, it pulls back and say, wait a second, what have we created? One other note that I'll mention, and I have a couple of testifiers, is when I first had a committee hearing on this, I had one testifier come up, and he challenged me and the rule and said, well, this is unconstitutional. And I went back and I looked at that and I said to myself, what is unconstitutional about that? And the claim was, well, it's unconstitutional that we can put legislative intent and then pull back and look at that. And I thought to myself, wait a second. We're the legislative body. We do the door knocking. We hear from our constituents. It's our job to come here, put legislative intent in place, and hope that intent is what we brought forth from our constituents. And you're now telling me it's unconstitutional for me to call time out and say, wait a second, let's make sure we got this right. Because at the end of the day, we all have to go back to our homes, we all have to go back to our bodies, to where we represent, and we have to say, I did the very best I could for you. I should not be able to go back and say, well, I kind of threw this out there and the agencies took over. It's our job as representatives, it's our job as lawmakers to bring the intent of our people here, to make sure those intents stay solid, and to keep asking those hard questions. If we can't ask those questions, and that's all this bill does, is allows us to have one more review process to say, is this what I really meant when we did legislative intent? So with that, members, I'm sure there'll be lots of great testimony. I will offer, we've been trying to work on many compromises. I've had an open door policy. We've had many of them. I think we've gotten as close as I can get to the center on this. At the end of the day, I need a certain amount of votes to get this passed. I believe I've gotten this as far as I can now to maintain agreement with all the parties. It may not go far enough for some. It may go too far for others. One thing that came up was what is this bill really doing? And I'm saying this is a transparency. And I know last session we tried to do some rulemaking changes. The intent was expediency, trying to make sure we get these things moving. My point to you is I want good rules, not quick rules. I want rules that we can actually say, yes, this was transparent, it did what it was supposed to do, and if we have to take a little bit more time to get it right, let's do that. And so, Madam Chair and members, the bill you have is in front of you with the fiscal note, and I would invite Mr. Brahms to come up as well to testify with me.
Okay. And as he's coming to the table, if there's anyone else that wishes to speak to this bill, please come forward. You can either grab a chair or you can sit in the chairs behind just to keep the flow of things.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Lloyd Grooms.
Welcome. I'm with,
excuse me. I meant Grooms.
Yeah, no problem. And I'm here solely to answer any questions that the committee may have.
Okay, well, we're not going to go to questions right now. We're going to go to testimony. I see we have one other person that wishes to testify to this bill. So please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Madam Chair and committee members, thank you. My name is Kirk Kadalka. I'm Assistant Commissioner with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. And today I'm representing more than just the MPCA. I am representing, and this remarks will be on behalf of the agencies as we've worked together. And I wanted to consolidate our statements to save and respect the time of the committee. Overall, I think it's good to talk a little bit about rulemaking and a reminder of some of the protections and transparency and that's built into the system already. And the first is rulemaking agencies cannot start this without the legislature authorizing it. So it is only once the legislature deems that the agencies need to do the additional work that it's done. And it's usually because of expertise in the subject matter is needed, full-time folks with specialized knowledge. And that ranges from Department of Labor and Industry working on workplace safety standards, Department of Human Services working on standards for mental health facilities, or the Department of Ag on meat inspections, or Department of Health on drinking water standards. The legislature has multiple ways to be involved in rulemaking. Agency, again, needs to have legislative authority to even conduct rulemaking. They can participate through the open process, through the Administrative Procedures Act that's overseen by the Office of the Administrative Hearings. Legislators can request review by the Legislative Coordinating Commission already. Legislators can put on hold rules during the process by both bodies, having the policy committees doing that. And legislators have the ultimate say by passing a bill to repeal or stop a rulemaking currently underway. I think it's important to talk about those protections and transparency that's there through the Office of Administrative Hearings that provides a number of those benefits. For instance, it makes sure an agency provides appropriate notices to the public and those impacted. It has the authority to make sure the agency stays within its authority granted by the legislature, and it makes sure the agency establishes the need and reasonableness of a rule. I think this standard is an important one to keep in mind. Minnesota has a very complex and process-heavy rulemaking procedure, already more oversight of rulemaking in Minnesota than most other states. For instance, if we compare it to the federal model that has a notice and comment and then the standard of arbitrary and capricious action by the feds, Minnesota has a much larger, robust public process and includes a reasonableness standard through the Statement of Need and Reasonableness and the Office of Administrative Hearings. And it's important because one of our concerns is this creates a mirror process at the Office of Legislative Auditor, which creates duplicative processes and redundancy, and we're just doing the same thing and creating delays. And so our high levels of concerns with the legislature is under the bill, economic impact trumps all other concerns, such as consumer protection, human health, privacy issues, when looking at the merits of a proposal. It equates any proposed rule that may carry more than a minimum a dollar amount as bad and puts a stop to it unless both bodies of the legislature agrees. And so some of the ways that this can have impacts is it doesn't consider what one sector's costs may be countered by direct savings in another. An example would be regulations on financial institutions. Those regulations may be more than $5 million in aggregate. However, the cost savings for data privacy, consumer protection, fraud protection could outnumber that 2-to-1. However, still, the rule would be put into this duplicative system. Others include short-term versus long-term gains. What's the cost of protecting health and vitality of a game and fish population versus its long-term benefit? Or looking at other benefits that don't have that easy-to-define economic impact. For instance, drinking water and food safety protections that result in healthier families. Those are hard to quantify. The second large concern we have is creating a duplicative and redundant process that results in increased cost with little to no value. As I mentioned earlier, the Office of Administrative Hearings, OAH, holds public hearings and takes testimony from interested parties. This bill creates another process where the OLA does it again. It determines the rule is needed in reasonableness as required under 14.14 Subdivision 2. Again, here, the OLA in the bill issues a similar report and again has to do similar reviews. The law already prevents an agency from enforcing guidance and bulletins and others as adopted as a rule through the Office of Administrative Hearing, 14.381. Instead, this creates a duplicative system going through the courts. And just to hit a little bit on that piece, the last two sections sets up a court system dealing with bulletins and the like. And the new proposal, different than what the OAH does, encourages actions to just delay guidance or rules because of a couple changes. For instance, the change grants an automatic stay without having to show any merit that there's a harm being done. Someone can just file this motion with the courts in the bill, and then the bulletin, guidance, or rule is then put on hold. Also, expenses are borne by the agency even if the court confirms the agency did no wrong. This is different than the Office of Administrative Hearings. Again, another reason that sets no consequences for someone just to file for delay, because they get the automatic delay, they don't have to have merit on that stay, and then the costs are borne even when they are proven wrong by the agencies. So we ask the question is, why is the need for the change? Where did the system not work in the last numerous years? Just a couple other notes, too. When talking about items that are more restrictive than federal guidelines, the statement of need and reasonableness already includes this. In Minnesota Statute 14.131, Item 7 requires a sonar to provide an assessment of each difference of the need and reasonableness of the difference, which is, again, reviewed by the Office of Administrative Hearings. We have no testimony on why that system is not working, what is not being done there. Also, the sonar does have a discussion of persons affected and the probable cost of those complying with the rule. That's different than the assessment that's asked for in Section 1 when we start talking about the impacts in investment, productivity, and innovation, a much more thorough and difficult item to do, which is why numerous agencies have an increased cost in here. And while I speak here for the agencies today, we have consulted with a number of other groups on this also, and they have mentioned that we can mention their names that also oppose the bill, and that includes the Minnesota AFL-CIO, the Service Employees International Union, Minnesota State Council, the United Steelworkers District 11, Education Minnesota, the Blue-Green Alliance, the Coalition of Environmental and Labor Groups, Minnesota Environmental Partnership, Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy, the Sierra Club, and Conservation Minnesota. Many of these groups are not seen together on the same side of a bill, such as the labor and environmental groups that are mentioned. But again, they all do oppose the changes here in the bill. In quick summary, agencies have been focusing on increased efficiencies in carrying out their duties and improved timeliness and transparencies as one of the items that are noted in the governor's budget that includes a proposal for increased transparency in rulemaking. The bill goes in the opposite direction by creating duplicative requirements, thus unnecessarily increasing costs and delaying important protections while adding little to no value. This bill would just stop proposed important public safety, health protections, worker and financial safeguards. We believe a more efficient approach, effective approach, is to focus on the specific and existing rule and proposed rules that raise concerns, using the existing tools the legislature and others have available. Thank you for your opportunity to share the agency's thoughts on this legislation. I'd be more than happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Representative Cresha.
And thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Kudelka, thank you. Mr. Kudelka has been in my office so much, I think you have a key now. But we've had lots of conversations. I know Representative Nelson, we've tried to work through many of these issues. I know where everyone stands on this, on all the sides on this. I understand that. Just a quick response to that with all the
agencies that you've heard and the organizations lining up against this. The question that I would pose is, what are they opposing? Are you opposing us, our ability as legislators, to do our job and to just make sure we get it right? If what we're really trying to do is just make legislation, turn it over to the agencies, and hope it turns out well for our districts, I'm not sure that's what we're here for.
Great. Representative Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And is it Mr. Kadelka? I know that I think it was in the last session that we had an expedited rulemaking authority come through. Can you tell us how that changed the rulemaking authority process that we used to have to what it is today?
Mr. Kadelka?
Madam Chair and committee members, there was a proposal brought forward by the agencies and the administration. It was not enacted in the law, so there have been no changes to the rulemaking process. The use of an expedited process in cases where a federal or state legislature or Congress or others specifically made the policy choice and the state had to just update its rules was one of the allowances, and there are other safeguards so that 25 signatures could kick it out of that process to the full rulemaking. But the agencies were believed it was important to have those safeguards in place, but it did not become law.
Representative Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, so but there are certain areas where we do have expedited rulemaking authority. We just didn't expand that. But I'm just looking at some of these costs, and I'm looking at that going, so does that mean that we're constantly changing the rules? How does someone out there in the doing business actually stay ahead of the game here? Because I know, you know, in construction, we changed, I think we're still under the 2007 construction code, and I know right now we're going through the process to adopt the newer codes, but at least those folks have had a number of years to understand what rules they've been building our houses and our new buildings under. Do the rest of these folks, are constantly changing, so they constantly have to adapt, and after we pass a law, you make the rules, and it just, they've got to adapt and watch not what the law says, but how the rule's going to affect them. Is that how I see that process working, and it's in a constant evolving process that the rules are always changing for these folks?
Mr. Kadelka.
Madam Chair and committee members, it's a very good question. The current process has a number of parts for public notice, and one of the largest roles that the Office of Administrative Hearings does in conjunction with the agency needs to put together a listing of all those potentially impacted by any rule changes, and that's approved by the Office of Administrative Hearings, and that serves as a notice. There are a number of notices processes, including the start where there's a request for proposal, where the agency say, we're thinking about making changes in this area, we'd like your feedback. Then it goes through a number of pieces there. Various agencies have other ways to outreach during that, after that time. I will speak for MPCA. We have a process where we send out draft rules during that time for comments. Then we enter another formal process dealing with the SONAR, the Statement of Need and Reasonableness, and the actual rulemaking language. Again, another public comment process where we have to outreach to those impacted under the guidance of the Office of Administrative Hearings that they need to look at it. The public then can have a public hearing under the Office of Administrative Hearings where everyone has an opportunity to have that say. All throughout the process, and when we make any changes, the Office of Administrative Hearing makes changes, or the rule is finally implemented, those do have to go out on public notices. So during the process, there are a number of public notices, and that is heavily watched by the Office of Administrative Hearings to make sure that folks are widely known about that. When we agencies do rulemakings, while we may have the agency that I work for, MPCA, may have five or so that are done each year, it doesn't mean that in 2 years those rules are then changed again. It is different sections of the rules that may be adopted. Rulemakings are also not quick endeavors. Just the Administrative Procedure Act takes 18 months to 2 years. That doesn't include the amount of time agencies usually work beforehand. Some of our scientific water quality rules, we have spent close to a decade, including the research and other work before we get to the final piece. So these aren't things that happen overnight. We make sure to include the public in this process.
Representative Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I understand when you say the public gets notice and the public, when you say that, how does the real public, as me, as a person out there, as the true public, are you saying that the notice goes to the citizens, or the notice goes to certain groups and people that are licensed in certain areas? The standard public, I'm going to use an example, if I own a building with an elevator in it, do I get notice that the elevator code's going to change, or some rule is going to change that affects how many times I have to have my elevator inspected, or a permit I have to have for the elevator? I, as a building owner, gets a notice on that?
Mr. Kudelka.
Madam Chair and committee members, it's a couple different ways. Some, as you mentioned, is associations sending out to various trade groups to help get that information to their members. But also many agencies have email list servers for folks to sign up, and then also general communications that go out when rulemakings have taken place. The system could be better, and it is why on the governor's budget there's a proposal to create a centralized rulemaking docket at the revisor's office that would help folks to be able to go to that. Right now, interested folks can go to each agency. We do propose that there's a better way to do that, have one centralized one-stop shop at the revisor's office.
Representative Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair, because I can tell you I cannot count the number of emails I've got from folks that are upset with new rules that came in to affect them, and they had no idea. I've had to respond to say, where did this come from? How did this change? What are you doing down there? And you've got to respond to them saying, hey, this happened in this legislative session, this law got passed, this is where the rule came from. And that takes a lot of time and effort on our part to respond to a constituent that has an elevator that all of a sudden he needs another $100 permit a year. He has no idea where it came from. So that's the frustrations that it comes from our side of the house on how these rules continue to change.
Representative Nelson.
Emails he's getting, I've got zero.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I passed out an example of an algorithm, I guess the PCA uses for drinking water, and just an example of the formulas that are used and uses to judge the cost versus the benefits. Concern I have with this bill, and I've been working with Representative Kresha and trying to move this, just like we did last year when I had the rulemaking bill that was referenced here that we were working on. You know, we worked with all parties on it to try and get it to a compromise in the middle, and I know the Representative Kresha has been working with me, and there's some groups that we met with. In fact, we met yesterday afternoon regarding an amendment that I see is not getting proposed that would have helped mitigate some of these costs that were in here. But I understand that's not being offered today. But this bill, as it's in its current form, it lists costs. It looks at only the cost of what it is to people, and it ignores the benefit. So there's no benefit that's being thing. And when you look at work and business, you look at cost versus benefit. It costs me this much for this, but this is the benefit I get out of it, and that outweighs the cost. We're not doing that here. We're only looking at costs. The other concern I have with this bill is that its current form is that this new duplicative system that's being set up, it's shifting the cost to the agencies, and I think that's why we have such a huge fiscal note here, is that they're going to bear all the costs of the current of the new system. They take it to court, they're going to have to pay both sides of the cost of it, and so that's where the costs are coming from. We're creating a bigger government out of this, and I said that's why in its current form I cannot support the bill.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Kreese, last night was the first time I had a chance to go through and look through the bill, and I was just trying to understand a little bit more thoroughly. The five-person panel, are those legislators that the Legislative Coordinating Commission sets up? Can you say a little bit about the five-person panel? I don't quite understand that.
Sure. Representative Kresha.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Johnson, for the question, and as well, Representative Nelson, I know you've been working really hard on this. That will be, as I understand it, I think I'm going to ask Mr. Grooms to come up and make sure I get this right, because the legislative auditor will convene a five-person panel. And that panel, I know who they're going to address, but I want to make sure I get the intent right.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Representative Johnson, I direct your attention to page 4, where it says the advisory panel must be made up of individuals who have not had a direct or who have not directly or indirectly been involved in the work conducted or contracted by the agency or who are not employed by the agency. So the concept is that the legislative auditor would actually impanel a group of experts to do the peer review. Those are the criteria that have been set in terms of the statute, in terms of the bill.
Representative Johnson.
Okay, so what role would the legislators have with respect to the review panel then? Anything?
None.
Madam Chair?
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, none. It's the legislative auditor who is actually creating the panel.
Representative Johnson.
Representative Kreisler, you had a...
Yeah, just to follow up to that, if I could, Madam Chair.
Go ahead.
So just quickly, we've heard it's duplicative and it's going to create more government. This is replacing the process. And what we're asking is this panel of experts will review this, and they will come back to us with a recommendation, at which time we can decide what proper action we can take, or we can try to give some messaging and guidance back to the agencies.
Okay. Representative Johnson?
Mr. Kadelka, a question for you just briefly. And I guess one of the things that troubles me about Bill just looking at it is the narrow definition of significant economic impact. Could you say a little bit more about that and, in your opinion, why that's problematic?
Mr. Kadelka.
Madam Chair and committee members, for the record, my name is Kirk Kadelka with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. As mentioned in Section 1 there, the first one is an easier estimate, the $5 million for the state. However, we do feel that it has a couple of concerns. Number one, it only looks at one side. For instance, if there are savings in another sector or the consumers, it's not counted against that, so it throws it into the new process. It doesn't take short-term or long-term protections into it. And then also some of those other parts of the ledger which are hard to quantify, public health, safety, those type of things. But then when we start looking at 2 and 3 here and look at geographical regions, and then also looking at investment, productivity, and innovation, the agencies do not have experience on determining what is a significantly adverse impact on innovation. It is a very a mushy term on what exactly that threshold would be, and so that would be very difficult for the agency to determine, and it would also be something the Office of the Administrative Hearings would have to determine. There would have to be an understanding how that is. So we believe there's some easily confusion on 2 and 3 on this.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Then this is my last question. So in terms of the need for the bill, where has the process, Representative Kreisler, in your opinion, failed or not worked that requires this kind of major change?
Representative Kreisler.
So, thank you, Representative Johnson. So, when you look at this, and let's look at the substantial economic impact, this is a trigger. This is not the end all. This is a trigger because in our communities, this is what we hear. This impacted my city, and it's going to cost me X amount of dollars. I didn't see this coming. Now I have to account for these dollars. Those of you that have been involved with county boards and city councils, you've seen this. And so what's not working is something is triggering, and why are we using economic impact? Because that's what always triggers the questions back up to us to ask, is this cost me a ton of money, and now I have to deal with it. So it's not that we're saying we're going to lower water quality standards, we're going to lower all these. All we're saying is when there are financial impacts that we get questions on, let's run this up the flagpole and say, wait a second, what happened here? That's what's not working, is what happened here? Let's reduce uncertainty. We may find through this process that it comes out and they say, we have to do this. The panel may say, this is wonderful. Continue to do this, at which time I'm asking us as legislators to remove plausible deniability. What I'm asking us to do is to go back to our district and say, I am accountable for the laws that we made. I've been through this process, I've recommended this, and this is the best we could do for you. What I'm asking us to remove, what's not working, is when I go back to my district and say, that rule was made, I'm sorry, there's nothing I can do.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Last question, I guess. What I was looking for is probably more concrete examples of where it hasn't worked in the state in the past. Anything in particular stand out that where it hasn't worked?
So here's what I tried to do, Representative Johnson. You said last question, I tried to go around it and I give you an answer, but now you've got me coming back to give you an answer. I appreciate that. So specific areas this has not worked. The sprinkler system. Where that rule was made and some of the guidances came back, it came right back into our laps as legislators, and we're fighting over this. Another example of this that came up, and I'm sorry I don't have the specific reference to it, but there was a construction project around Stillwater where one of the agencies said, hey, we need some guidance on here. We want to reduce wake zones and so forth because as we're doing this construction process, it needs to be safe and there's none. Then the agency came back and said, well, we're going to expand that a little bit. We need to go to some more waterways. Next thing you know, the agency was asking for the ability to do this statewide. And so these are examples that I keep hearing. Some of them are anecdotal. Some of them are quantitative. And what I'm saying to us is we just need to be able to insert ourselves to ask those questions. So I don't know if that specifically gets to where you're at. I can tell you, and I know from the agency's point of view, some of these are probably anecdotal. Some of these are we're hearing from our district saying, can you go deal with this? But some of them are quantitative. When I take you to the fire sprinklering, those are rules that we are dealing with that have substantial impacts.
All right, Representative Pugh.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to start by thanking Representative Kreisha for bringing this bill and more importantly, to underscore all of the work that I know that you've done. You have had an open door, and I know that many people have poured in through that door, and I really have an appreciation for what you've done. The comment that I want to make really puts an exclamation point on Representative Howe's comments. His excellent comments that this is a really important conversation that we need to be having. I know from serving on government operations last session, biennium, I learned so much and took a really great interest in this whole rulemaking process and was simply shocked to know, and I have a feeling that a lot of people listening to this don't have an appreciation for how rules have, once they're promulgated, have the full force and effect of law. And I knew that there were, I don't know that any of us really know how many rules were promulgated, the number of rules, the number of pages, this past even year or biennium, for example. But just earlier, I was up, earlier this session, I was up on the sixth floor at the revisor's office working on a project and was shocked to see that the number of volumes of rules equal the number of volumes of statutes. And so that is really telling how many rules are promulgated by non-legislators, to what degree do we have oversight over those rules, and the impact that this has on unsuspecting businesses and citizens is, I think, staggering. And so I do think that this is a really important conversation to have, and I'm looking forward to supporting your bill. So, thank you.
Representative Kahn.
Madam Chairman, first of all, I'd like to thank Mr. Kudelka and the people that he worked with for having one person come and testify what the agencies were doing. Can you imagine how long this would have gone on if all of the people he listed had come individually? So I just want to point out to people that we are a part-time legislature, that a lot of these things have really need intense technological expertise in order to get into it. We have really good staff, but I doubt that there are many people that in the legislature who are willing, and legislative staff who are capable or willing to put in the degree of knowledge and expertise it would take to deal with these certain issues. I mean, fire safety. I just can't imagine many of us having enough knowledge to deal with it. And the learning curve for this stuff is just incredible. So I know You know, we do have a process in place for complaint about rules, for listening to it, for hearings about it. But I think more involvement is not just a bad idea, but that it's really impossible to achieve on a quality-driven basis. So,
I have Representative Nelson, and then we're going to move on to the Carolyn Lane bill. So, Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just want to correct a couple, maybe one thing that Representative Cretia said. You know, when he says, when we say that I don't have any way to stop this, well, under current law, committee chairs, if there's a rule that they want, they can stop it till the end of legislative session by having hearings on it and stopping a proposed or delaying a proposed rule from going into effect. And the other way we as legislators have to fix a rule that may have been a bad rule is that we can propose legislation and put it in to change a rule to pass it. So, I mean, to say, when you say to a constituent, I can't do anything about it, I think you're, in a way, abdicating your authority as a legislator to be able to fix these things as you go along. And that's, so I just want to make sure we know that when we as legislators say we can't do anything about it, there are things we can do. We can pass laws to change the rules, and we can also, as a committee chair and as a committee, we can, if a rule we think is, we're hearing that's having a bad effect, we can have hearings and we can delay it and possibly get legislation passed to change it before the end of session. But we can do that so that, you know, when we say we can't do anything, I think that's kind of being disingenuous to our voters.
Representative Cretia, last word.
Thank you. I've spent more than enough time with you today.
Madam Chair.
with that, members, Representative Johnson.
Excuse me. Could we get a roll call on this?
Sure. We're laying it over for possible inclusion. So
that's okay then.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. We're laying this bill over for possible inclusion in the state government finance on this bill. Thank you, Representative Cretia. We'll see you later.
And thank you for the conversation. Scones will be on.
Okay, members, we have Representative Lane's bill, House File 1353. I'm going to move this bill to be laid over for possible inclusion in the state government finance bill. Representative Lane, do you want to come to the table? And folks, because I'd wanted to spend a little bit more time on this bill than what we have, if you are looking to testify to this bill, if you can put yourself in the chairs back behind the testifier table, that just makes sure that we are maximizing our time that we have here today. So, Representative Lane, to your bill.
Sorry about that. Thank you.
Representative Lane, I see that you have an amendment. If you want to move your amendment.
Yes, Madam Chair, I would like to move the A6 amendment.
Have you gotten?
And can you just walk us through briefly what it does?
The amendment does some a few things that I've worked with some of the councils to adjust. It adjusts the quorum a little bit because we're having legislators voting, so we need to have a slightly lower quorum. So if we're not there, they can still meet. It adds business and economic development as one of the possibilities that are in their duties. It refines the process of hiring the executive director a little. It's some of the things I've worked with the councils on.
Okay. Members, any questions to the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A6 amendment, please say aye.
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 Those opposed? Okay, now we have the bill in the order that you wish it to be. Representative Lane, to your bill.
Thank you. Well, I sit on the Asian Pacific Council, and I've done so in the last 2 years and continue to do so now this biennium. And as you know from our informational hearing several weeks ago, last year in 2014, the OLA did a programmatic review of the work of the four councils, Asian Pacific, Black, Latino, and Indian Affairs. The report had concerns about whether the ethnic councils were actually supporting their enabling statutes as well as they should be. This bill addresses the shared statutory purposes of the operation of three of these four councils. The Indian Affairs Council is not included at this time because of their sovereignty and jurisdictional issues. So while I think it's important to keep these councils rather than eliminate them, I personally value the process that is possible when people are working together on shared values. It's always messier, though. But the end result can be deeper and richer and can actually build community. When people engage together on issues and collaborate on solutions, something more happens than the actual work they get done. Then their communities actually strengthen, They find a place in our democratic processes. They both trust governments a bit more, and they're more engaged with it, and they become more a living part of the structure of government. So this is important, especially as we welcome new immigrants from all these areas, Asia, Africa, and Latin and South America. I think there's a value here far greater than even the statutory purposes can name. I also believe that the councils, that eliminating the councils and creating a more removed structure inside an agency or at a major new department actually increases the gap between the communities and the government. It's more paternalistic, and as if one person could address the issues of all the varieties of the cultural groups within that one ethnic group. And it doesn't empower the people into our democratic processes. So I do believe in the power of collaboration and empowerment. However, this means the statutory purpose and operation of these councils must be clarified, and that's what this bill does. It puts the three councils under one statute. Although their constituencies are different, their legislative purpose is the same. The bill follows the advice of the OLA to narrow and focus the duties of the council. Under the new overall mission of working for the implementation of economic, social, legal, and political equality for their constituency, come four duties that are to be accomplished in interaction with the legislature and the governor. These continue as the same basic statutory duties as now. Advise us about issues confronting your constituencies. Advise us about legislative and administration changes that are needed to improve the economic and social condition. Advise us about the implication and effects of the things that we or the administration are proposing. Be a liaison for us, between the organizations and us. There's many organizations out there doing good work for this particular purpose, but they don't necessarily have access into state government, and that's what the council's job is to do, is to bridge that gap. Although these are the same four duties that they currently have, I have listed under them possible actions on ways that they could work to take these four broad goals and do measurable objectives within them. I do not make these ideas mandatory because that would require them to do them just as listed. For instance, they could do surveys or community forums and present the results to us. They could bring forth politically feasible legislation and help work for its passage. They could make recommendations about the state's affirmative action program. They could help expand the list of minority businesses that are registered at the Department of Administration, that are the list that the state agencies can then procure services and supplies from. This is called the Targeted Small Group Business Program. They could work with state agencies or organizations to promote business and economic development. There's public tax dollars that we give them cannot go into the major programmatic work, but there are nonprofits and business groups out there that have these resources, and they can collaborate with them to actually and make the reach of the councils even greater. But also this bill brings accountability. Not only does this bill suggest possible ways they could accomplish these duties, but these councils must have a strategic plan based on the statutory duties. And they must have achievable objectives, action steps, and measurable outcomes each year. The committees in the House and the Senate that have jurisdiction over them will hold them accountable to these outcomes. Each year, the committees will require them to report on the measurable outcomes for that year and what they plan to accomplish in the following year. Perhaps most importantly, and because the success of a diverse group of people working together depends on good leadership, a key change in this bill will have the executive director's hiring process and annual performance reviews managed by the Legislative Coordinating Commission's executive director in consultation with the councils. Briefly, the LCC is made up of legislators, it is bipartisan and bicameral, and it's headed by the Speaker of the House and the President of the Senate. It will fall to the Executive Director of the LCC to do this job. The LCC will not participate in the daily operation of the councils, and it will not be the operational boss of the Executive Director. But we are asking a lot of these Executive Directors in providing leadership to the councils for a very big task, helping us reduce disparities. And I, for one, think that this new hiring and evaluation process will serve us and the councils well. The director of the LCC will see input from the councils and the communities in hiring and evaluating the executive directors. I will say that I spent some time trying to find a place for this kind of work, one of the reasons I chose the LCC is because it's kind of removed from the variable political winds that's possible in this political world. The executive agencies change with every governor, but the LCC is always bipartisan, bicameral, and fairly stable. Even though hired in this fashion, the executive directors will continue to be executive branch employees as they are now. They will continue to work with the Department of Administration to manage the operation of the council as they do now. They will hire and supervise a few staff who are also executive branch employees as now. The executive directors and the council members will work together to carry out the statutory duties. When I'm asked, well, who is their boss? I say, the enabling statutes. And they will keep each other on their toes just as now. The executive director's job depends on doing the statutory duties of the council well. And as now, the councils determine the strategic plan and participate in evaluating the directors. In my experience with the Asian Pacific Council, the council members have actually become more empowered as the executive director and the legislative members have become more clear and articulate on the statutory duties of the council. And this has been a joy for me to watch. Other details in the bill include duties listed for the board members in order to ensure the councils have a working boards and that the legislative members, one from each party in the House and each party in the Senate, will have voting rights. This makes them more active members. And the executive directors and legislative members can offer advice to the governor on appointments. Another thing that the OLA pointed out, that the governor didn't know who to appoint. But because these legislators and executive directors are state employees, they can see the applications that have been put forth. So this should help speed up the appointing process. With the bipartisan bicameral legislative members, this process will be nonpartisan and focused on the expertise and background of the potential board members. There are details also in the bill for the operations of the council with attendance requirements and board member duties, term limits, training in open meeting laws and data privacy, etc., and a way to transition from where we are now to the new. So I support retaining the ethnic councils with the revisions in this bill. I think there are still too many disparities in our society, and we need the help of the communities in working for more equity. Also, each of these communities have new immigrants that can use support in becoming integrated into not only our society, but into our democratic processes that sometimes very different from the ones that they have known. As I said, I always err on the side of collaboration and personal empowerment, and I truly believe that these communities can't solve the disparities without our help, and we can't do it right without their participatory help. So as far as supporters for this legislation, the Asian Pacific Council has voted to endorse this bill and has worked with me to recommend changes. Not all the members have voted in support of this bill, but the majority does. I've worked with the other two councils also to varying degrees of success. I have incorporated suggestions from both of them. There are a lot of misunderstandings being spread, but there are two suggestions that do not serve this process well. One is that this bill is just retaliation for our work, and the other one is, let's just table it and spend more time talking about it. Those don't help. I have messages from two supporters who can't be here today. Dai Tao, a St. Paul City Council member from Ward 1, called me to say I can use his name as a supporter of this bill. And Dr. Fatima Lawson, Vice Chair of the Black Council and St. Paul Public Schools Principal, gave me permission to read these words from her. Quote, we desperately need some intervention and accountability. There are people who are afraid to speak up for fear of repercussion. Everyone is counting on the legislators to do something about this situation and soon. In regard to some of the claims that this bill is just retaliation for monitoring affirmative action and could end equal opportunity monitoring and enforcement, she says, quote, legislators proposing to hold us more accountable for the work we claim to do on behalf of our people is not ending equal opportunity for our people. And then as board member and vice chair, I care a lot about this council and work that we do on behalf of our people, but we need more accountability. Well, as you might expect, each council has people with opposite opinions regarding this bill, often with some misunderstandings as to what it actually does. Change can be challenging, but change in these councils is imperative. Let us attend to the needed changes in this session. It is my belief and hope that with these changes, these councils can continue and can carry out their enabling statutes more effectively. So I would like Commissioner Kevin Lindsay from the Minnesota Department of Human Rights to share some of his work in surveying the community about their opinions and suggestions for these councils. He does have a longer presentation, but I'm hoping he can focus more on what he's heard from the community.
And Commissioner, to that point, because we want to make sure that we have equal time for everybody, so if you could, Commissioner, be brief in your comments.
Okay, I'll
Commissioner, please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Sure. My name is Kevin Lindsay. I'm the Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Human Rights. Last year, the legislature gave us some funding to provide and conduct a survey, and we did conduct a survey as it relates to what people wanted as relates from their state ethnic councils. And I do want to focus in, and I do have materials which have been provided to you. Pages 16 to 20, within those materials, I'm going to limit my comments to that area of the presentation. That focuses in on the feedback that we received. First and foremost, we did not hear anyone within the community to say, eliminate the councils. We did not hear that at all. We did hear people saying that the councils, as they're currently structured, weren't operating in a most efficient manner that they could. So we heard change. And maybe for the legislature, it's reminiscent sort of a comment by Winston Churchill, is that a lot of people, you know, complain about democracy, but at the end of the day, it is still the best form of government. So in this sense, there are some good things as it relates to what the council does, it can do, but there are some needed changes as it relates to it. And people saw that that was something important, especially for us as a state, as we become more diverse, for us to be intentional about the participation between people of color and the government entities which manage their day in and day out lives. Creating a single Office of Minority Affairs. Again, there was consistency among all ethnic groups as relates to that this was not something that was desired. And when we take a look at the extensive diversity within each of the ethnic, broad ethnic communities within the state of Minnesota, it is staggering how many different countries have expatriates that are here in the state of Minnesota. To think that one individual or one office could manage the incredible diversity of representation of all the ethnic groups within the state and be able to say and state with a singular voice what was needed for all of those individuals, no one thought that that was possible. Now, that doesn't mean that it's not important to have those voices be represented, but just to think of it having one single Office of Minority Affairs, again, was uniformly rejected. Board composition. Board stakeholders felt that the board composition needed to be updated to reflect the changing demographics which were going on. And if you look at the demographic structure for the board composition on the current councils, it is varied. So for the Council on Latino Affairs, it mirrors sort of the representation that we have for congressional districts within the state. For the Council for Asian Pacific Minnesotans, it has more than 15 members. It actually has 23 members. You also have, for the Council on Black Minnesotans, this distinction between East and West African of having one representative from East and West African countries. And I would suggest to you that the countries which were identified at the point in time with the passage have not kept up changing demographics of African immigrants. And to that point, there is no reference at all within the Council on Black Minnesotans as it relates to Somalia. And in our state has more individuals from Somalia than any area in the entire world. When I had a chance to meet with Ambassador Nicholas Kay, Special Envoy to the United Nations, he made reference to that fact here in the Twin Cities, that we have the largest expatriates of Somalia in the entire world. How can it be that our state statute doesn't even reflect that reality today? There's a need for the legislature to look at the board composition and the structure. Term limits. Again, the history of the respective councils was to create an opportunity for people to be involved in the political process. We've had some board members who have been on there for quite some period of time. Members within the respective communities felt that the use of turnover within those particular positions would allow the growth of future leaders to be able to go into different areas. And that would also bring vibrancy to the respective ideas and opinions which would be brought before the respective board. Again, we did not come up with a specific opinion as it relates to whether it should be 4 or 6 or 8, but the advice coming back to the legislature from the community was examine the issue of term limits. The last, as it relates to the supervision of the executive directors, there was a clear need to create some accountability as it relates to the executive directors. And again, Representative Lane's comments are so poignant in that there were some individuals who felt that the executive directors in some agencies had been unfairly treated, and others, there was a feeling among community members that the legislature had abandoned respective community members and allowed executive directors to do as they please without any accountability to various communities. Ultimately, look at the respective structure as relates to the executive director to see how that can best work for these respective communities.
After 88 years of combined experience.
We are at a very interesting point in time. Our entire country is really going through what I would say a point of our democracy, and how do we fundamentally make it stronger and make it work for all. And similar to how we locked ourselves in a room for 7-8 years to draft the Constitution to make it work for all, we may be at some similar point in time, an analogous point in time, where we really need to sit across from one another, sometimes different gender, different race, different ethnicity, to really make the democracy work for us all. The councils can be a part of that process, and I would suggest that the legislature has a great opportunity to make Minnesota stronger, not just today, but well into the future.
Thank you, Commissioner. Ms. Herr, I am going to limit you to 2 minutes, and I'm going to cut you off after 2 minutes in order to make sure that we have enough time for anybody that wishes to speak in opposition to this bill. So, Ms. Herr, 2 minutes.
All right. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Sia Herr, and I am the Executive Director at the Asian Council. As you know, I'm starting my third year as director, and while that is not an extremely long tenure, it has been long enough for me to understand our role and responsibilities as a state agency, and more specifically, why the Office of the Legislative Auditor Auditor's report was at times scathingly critical of our council. We accept that there is need for change. Mr. Tran and I have come before you before to talk about the meaningful changes that have taken place at our council in the time I have been on board. These changes, while promising, were only possible because of a few good board members, and I suspect that many of these changes are not sustainable. Madam Chair, the last time we came before this committee, you ended the hearing by saying that we cannot count on a good executive director to come along once in a long while. And so in the same vein, I'm telling all of you that we cannot depend on a few good board members to come along every decade or so. We need the changes that House File 1353 is proposing. I believe that this bill builds on what we know can work and what we know need to be done away with. Our Asian Council is the point of entry for many communities. We are a supporter for communities, and we are a partner of communities. House File 1353 will help make this process the standard and make it more replicable. That's why I'm here today to ask that you support the bill, or actually, more accurately, I'm here to plead with you that you do all that you can to help ensure that House File 1353 passes during this legislative session. I know how busy all of you are. I know that the councils of color are not very high on most legislators' list of priorities. In spite of what I know, I still hope that at least some of the legislators who know that this bill will be coming before them this session are watching, listening, and have the courage to ask difficult questions. We have been in many of your offices, but we have not been in every legislator's office. In these meetings, I have shared with many of you why legislative change must come this session, but I have not shared with you all the reasons why. I should not have to on both accounts, however, because the Office of the Legislative Auditor has come before you several times now, And even if I could sit down with each and every one of you and articulate yes, sir. Every one of the reasons why change must come, it would all come down to this.
Great, thank
Please
you.
Do what you can to help pass House File 1353. Thank you.
Thank you. If Mr. McDonald, I understand that you're opposed to the bill. If you want to come forward to the table and speak in opposition to the bill, we will then, according to my this clock, we will go to 9:49 for anyone that wishes to speak in opposition to the bill. Mr. McDonald.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Edward McDonald. I'm the Executive Director of the Council on Black Minnesotans. And I will attempt to make my comments, abbreviate my comments, because we've been before the committee before in opposition to House File 1353. We do have some visitors from Greater Minnesota that have traveled in that would like to comment on this legislation as well.
Madam McDonald, we'll, as long as it's within that window of time, we will be able to hear from them.
Okay. Thank you,
well,
Madam Chair.
On how much you say.
Okay. I'm going to try to be brief, but it's an important issue. Madam Chair, as you know, and I spoke before, that we had introduced legislation, House File 1418, that was a two-year process that our community engaged in to help us with framing the operational approach they felt was important to them in order for our council to meet their needs. I want to just point out that Representative Lang has not attended any meetings in our community or even the council board meeting. And I do not believe that Representative Lang or the OLA is the operational experts on what our council has done. And I won't go into the OLA matter because I used the opportunity that you scheduled for us to do that. What I'd like to do, Madam Chair, is address the other foundational premise that Representative Lane has put forth to this committee and legislative body regarding the need for the changes that she's proposing. And those premises are disparities, underrepresentation, and underutilization of protected class citizens in the state of Minnesota. Committee members, when you hear the ferocious cry for racial justice and equity, and the marketplace is proliferated with disparity reports, you are hearing from the marketplace that something's amiss with the administrative application of equal access and opportunity laws. Madam Chair and committee members, our communities are asking for the state to commit to employing cultural agility in state government operations and by extension in the marketplace. Cultural agility is the employment of individuals and entities with cultural and linguistic competence to diversify an institution's professional base so that congruent behaviors, attitudes, and policies can come together that enable effective work in cross-cultural situations, diverse cultural communities, and to reduce institutional isms. Minnesota has three equal opportunity laws that help achieve cultural agility if they are complied with administratively. They are the most forward-thinking of any state in this country and are as Minnesotans, as Minnesota, as the loon. The administrative application of the Procurement Act, Minnesota Statute 16C, the Affirmative Action Act 43A, and investment in 363A, the Human Rights Act, is where the rubber meets the road in terms of eradicating and preventing disparities in state government operations and by extension the marketplace. Madam Chair and the committee, our governor of this great state did not retaliate against us by weakening our long-standing state mandate to monitor and advise on improvements to procurement, affirmative action, human rights laws when we reported to his policy officials that major concerns exist with the administrative application of these laws. He took action to address our concerns by sending recommendations to you for consideration, issuing an executive order, and initiating other several administrative actions. Madam Chair and Committee, we also introduced legislation that addressed this matter, but it will not get a hearing on our idea. If the committee members are interested in our legislation to address this concern, it is House File 1364. Madam Chair and committee members, the Council on Black Minnesota's major concerns with House File 1353 are as follow. We spent 2 years working with our community to fashion the changes to our operations they felt were best to meet their needs. As I said before, Representative Lane never once met with our community or our board to solicit their input with the development of her proposal. The Council of Black Minnesotans will no longer be, under the Lang Bill, a quasi-state agency because the legislation establishes three different reporting authorities for the council. The council board reports to the governor, the executive director to the legislative coordinating committee, and all other council staff to the executive branch, creating a dysfunctional line of administrative and governance accountability. It essentially eliminates the council's long-standing history for monitoring affirmative action and equal opportunity compliance in state government operations. This action seems to be a hidden retaliation for carrying out this mandate with regards to reporting on affirmative action and equal opportunity compliance, which works counter to the state's whistleblower protection law under Minnesota Statute 181932. The bill may facilitate disparate treatment of certain protected class communities because similarly situated councils are not subjected to these changes. For example, the Disability Council, which serve protected class people but are not subject to the provisions of this bill. The apparent difference between them and our organization is that their staff is white. That would be a violation of 363A and 43A. The bill may create an unequal approach for protected class groups to participate in state legislative making process in violation of Minnesota Statute 3C.03 and 3C.035. Because we would have to go through a political feasibility test for recommendations that would come forward from our community. The bill as amended by Representative Lane does not state any specific statutory purpose, which she claimed is what she was trying to get at in focusing the work of the councils. And the repeal of the existing enabling statute so that there is no statutory purpose for the LLC or the legislature or the executive branch to use to determine if a statutory purpose is met, which she claimed is the major reason for the legislation. Finally, Madam Chair and members, there is no foundation for this legislation other than to retaliate for our advocacy for strengthening equal opportunity in the state government contracting, hiring, and curtailing the disinvestment in human rights enforcement so that we can curtail underutilization of protected class people in state government operations and by extension in the marketplace. Madam Chair and members, the laws on the books before the establishment of these forward-thinking equal opportunity laws led by great Minnesotans on the federal level like Vice President Hubert Humphrey, Walter Mondale, NAACP Director and Minnesotan Roy Wilkins, Governor Wendell Anderson and Levander, before their work, the laws on the books were Jim Crow laws and slavery laws. We ask you, do you want to send us back to that era? You don't have to answer that question. It's rhetorical. And we will learn that with your vote. We ask you to vote no to House File 1353. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members, for allowing us to comment and for the great work you do on behalf of this great state of Minnesota.
Thank you, Mr. McDonald. Is there anyone else that wishes to testify in opposition to this bill? We have six more minutes, and then what we will do is we will open it up to questions to members. If you could please state your name for the record and who you
represent. Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Barbara Jordan. I'm from Rochester, Minnesota. I'm on the executive board for the Minnesota Dakota State Council and also a member of the local committee for the Council on Black Minnesotans in Rochester, Minnesota. Thank you for allowing us the opportunity to comment on House File 1353. We believe that there is a desire on the part of some to weaken the council's ability to monitor and report on and advocate for improved state governmental equal opportunity compliance and, by extension, in the marketplace. Madam Chair and committee members, the Council on Black Minnesotans supports House File 1418 and Senate File 1650, which is our community-driven legislation for expansion of the Council on Black Minnesotans operations. The Council on Black Minnesotans organizational expansion legislation grew out of 2 years of planning and evaluation with our community to determine how best to restructure our operations to best meet the needs of our communities. The Council on Black Minnesotans operational expansion legislation adds $300,000 to our base appropriations each year to achieve in part the following: to operate satellite offices in Rochester, Duluth, Mankato, and St. Cloud, to change the name of the council to the Council for Minnesotans of African Heritage, to increase the number of governor appointments to 13 with representation from African Americans, Caribbeans, East Africans, and West Africans. It also allows for the monitoring and recommendation of actions that improve affirmative action and equal opportunity compliance in state government operations and, by extension, in the marketplace. House File 1353 does not do those things that our community would want the council to do, and we respectfully ask that you vote against the bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Jordan. Is there anyone else wishing to testify? If you can please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Madam Chair and members, my name is W.C. Jordan, and I'm the Minnesota Dakotas Area State Conference President for the NAACP. In the brief time that I have here, I just want to speak to the community involvement with the bill. You know, there's a two-year campaign by the Council on Black Minnesotans, and when we invited the council director to our state conference meeting, and he told us what he wanted to do. The NAACP membership over the state in Duluth, St. Cloud, St. Paul, Minneapolis, Rochester, we got behind his efforts. We went to the different meetings that he had. The meetings that were conducted were planning meetings where we brought issues from the community of the black and brown community in Minnesota. These meetings and the agendas were sent out to all of our local branches, to general membership meetings, to all of our members across the state. So when we look at the bills that the council have put forward, bills House File 1418 and Senate File 1650, those are bills that were helped crafted by the people in the communities around Minnesota. The involvement was there. We heard from the Human Rights Commissioner, Kevin Lindsay, who came forward, and he went around the state, and the NAACP was very instrumental in getting people to those meetings. Of course, they were not as well attended as some of the planning meetings, but overwhelmingly, the support for the council was there from the grassroots people. Representative Lane did not reach out to the NAACP and the community at large, and we think that's important because when we look at House File 1353 that we're opposed to, it's not inclusive of the people, and I think that that is the important and overriding issue here when we look at what's been done, the meetings that the people went to. We've had branches that have brought 50 students to the Capitol in support of the council's bills. So we're here before you today to ask you to vote no on House File 1353.
Thank you, Mr. Jordan. And we've got one more minute left, and if you can please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Yes, my name is Denise Foley. I'm president of the Central Minnesota NAACP for the St. Cloud area to Fargo, North Dakota. I'm here in support of the Council on Black Minnesotans. For the past 2 years, the St. Cloud NAACP has been working very extensively with the Council on Black Minnesotans. A lot of our state representative, Jeb Knoblauch, Peterson, they have been collaborating extensively with the NAACP in terms of the efforts. We have some critical issues that are going on in Minnesota with respect to our Somali population. We have partnerships with the Central Minnesota Somali Organization, SASO, strong partnerships that collaborate with the NAACP as well as the Council on Black Minnesotans. I'm not sure of all of the politics that's going on behind the bill trying to eliminate the council, but I'm here to ask you not to vote against the council and changing that structure. I can honestly say Edward McDonald and others on the council have been out in Central Minnesota helping with that effort. As far as the Minnesota Department of Human Rights, I partner with the local representative. I can honestly say that I have not seen the Minnesota Department from the state level out in Central Minnesota advocating for the rights of Central Minnesota residents. And I'm not sure, with all due respect to Representative Lane, I'm not sure why she introduced the bill in the surrounding. I'm not here to criticize her or any others. I'm asking you to table that bill and vote for the council to stay in full operation. We need all the help we need at in Central Minnesota, in addition to getting other offices of the council on a local level out there. We're the NAACP. We're one organization out there, and I employ that you keep the council in full operation. We will continue to work with our local state representatives as well. Thank you for giving me the time.
Thank you, Ms. Foley. At this time, we are going to go to questions from members. My first question is going to be for Mr. Garcia, and I do believe that Representative Moran wanted to speak to the bill. I encourage you to come up to the table. So, Mr. Garcia, if you could come to the table. My question for you, we have heard now from two of the councils. What is your perspective on this bill, and can you give us some feedback in brief time?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to speak before you. We met the Vice Chair of the Council, Mr. Perez, and myself with Representative Lane, and I'm very happy to see that she made some of the changes that we had requested, and especially the focus on collaboration, the focus on dialogue between our communities and the majority community and the legislature and the executive committee. We have some questions that hopefully can be addressed at this point or later. If we're executive branch employees, why are we being placed under the legislative branch, namely the Legislative Coordinating Commission? That doesn't seem to make logical sense to us, and there are some concerns also about the divisions that seem to be created in this process, and we would hope that we can help bridge this controversy. This is a highly, highly important issue, as Representative Nash pointed out some weeks ago, that we need to broaden the scope of the significance of the contribution that the councils can make at a time when we can go in one of two directions, and I think the direction of collaboration and communication, improve dialogue, that even the OLA has recommended that the legislators listen more to the councils, and that we become more accountable and more responsible. I would totally agree. And I would just like to ask someone who came here from Rochester to speak very briefly to the committee about what we are trying to do that might provide an example of this collaboration. Regina Seabrook would like to speak for a minute.
Good morning. Seabrook, and then we're going to get to the question. Representative Lane, you've got the question from Mr. Garcia.
Ms. Seabrook. Thank you for the opportunity to speak. We have some wonderful synergy in Rochester where our councils of color, our Council on Black Minnesotans, and our Chicano Latino Affairs Council have not only been catalysts for community organizations of color to partner with our local institutions, civic and political. We have an early childhood pilot going. We have numerous projects to support increased graduation rates. We partner actively with MDE and higher ed. And I saw an opportunity within the LCC. You have an office on the economic status of women, and I was wondering, how is progress measured for this office? How is success defined? And what examples of cross-sector partnerships exist? Because I'm wondering if the governing structure of that organization, which addresses disparities that affect women of color and families of color, is as effective as the work that we are doing in Rochester, working as councils of color, partnering with one another. Thank you.
Okay, and Representative Lane, to Mr. Garcia's question. Was why, as executive branch employees, are we being moved to the legislative branch?
They're not being moved to the legislative branch. They're simply, we're using the services of the LCC executive director to participate with the councils in hiring and evaluating the performance of the executive directors. It, I call it a hybrid. It's certainly workable. And it allows participation with the councils in doing this important job, but they continue as they are now, employees of the executive branch.
Okay. Members, any questions? Representative Johnson.
Briefly, I had a question for Sia Herr. Is she still here?
Ms. Herr.
And as you come down, I just wanted to hear, just very briefly, what are you hearing from the Asian community about this whole issue?
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, thank you for the question. As Executive Director, I spend most of my time in the community, and since the OLA report has been published, I have heard, sadly, nothing really positive about the Asian Council. I think for many years now, the community has felt that the council hasn't been doing its job. And, you know, what the community, what conversations have yielded is the finding that our communities are waiting for you to take action. And then it has been my observation that you are waiting for our communities. So the conclusion at the end of the day is, let us not wait for each other anymore. The ball is in your court to affect change. You heard Representative Lane said earlier that community members are afraid of consequences. There's so much to be said for cultures of communities, and so I can't tell you enough about it right now, but the answer is that communities are waiting for you to take action. And you have heard from Representative Lane that we have community leaders supporting this bill.
Representative Johnson, oh,
thank you.
Members, any other questions? If we don't, Representative Moran, I know you wanted to speak to the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. So, again, my name is Rena Moran, State Representative, District 65A, and I am here today standing with Representative Lane. I'm also the second author on this bill. When this bill was put together, it came from collaboration of many people saying that change has to happen. And so I also like to inform you that I am also a community member. I am a mother. I am very engaged in the community with just nonprofits, community members, leaders, and have great relationship and partnership with community members and organizations and businesses. So as I come before you today as a legislator, I also come to you bringing those voices from the community. And so, as we know, in 1980, the first council was created, and that was 35 years ago. And 35 years ago, that legislators who recognized that there was a voice missing here at the Capitol on laws and policies that were being created. So I really, appreciate those legislators at that time who were saying that, you know, here we are creating laws and policies and there's a voice and a presence missing. And so we're going to create some councils to help us create laws that would work for all of us around the state. And so when I look at the councils, I look at them for that purpose, that they are here to help this body create laws and policies that are going to be effective and it's going to work for all of us. But we can say, and I'm sure some of us have said, that that presence has been missing from this body here. So what this bill do is it brings some focus and effectiveness and accountability to both the communities they represent and to this body. And so again, I come before you in support of House 51353. It is our responsibility to address the key findings of the OL report. And I think, again, this is what House File 1353 does. This bill addresses the shared statutory purpose and operation of three of the four councils. The Indian Affairs Council is not included at this time due to their sovereignty and jurisdictional issues. I believe it's hugely important to keep the councils. I personally value what they can and do to enhance policies passed out of this body to become law. I believe in them wholeheartedly, that they was created for a valid purpose and they are still needed today more than ever. But House File 1353 helps with this process. House File 1353 brings intentional focus and direction to the councils of color so they are working towards the economic, social, legal, and political equality for their constituencies. This, again, is important as we look at the policies that are moving through the legislature. We need their voices here. I have received letters from the West African community, and I believe you guys have also received some of those support of House File 1353. We've also received letters and been in conversations with the African American community, the Asian community, all who are in support of some more accountability within the councils of color. There's absolutely no room to talk, to table this bill and allow the councils to engage their community more. This is something they should have already done, and at this point, we need them to be effective and accountable. Now, so I support retaining the ethnic councils with the revisions of House File 1353. We have too many disparities in our society, and we need the help of the communities in working more in working for more equity by council members who know how to operate this process. House File 1353 will help the councils in this process to be more effective, to be more accountable to the people in which they represent across the state of Minnesota. Communities can't solve the disparities without our help, and we can't do it right without the participatory help that they bring to this body. So I just want to just close by saying that I would never support or co-author a bill that would take away the power of the people, the voices of the people, and their ability to engage in the process. I just ask for you to respond now and to support House File 1353.
Thank you, Representative Moran. Members, any questions? Seeing none, Representative Lane, closing comments?
One small comment that I will just make, because I think this went by very well, is that we have to remember that these are state agencies. They're not nonprofits out there doing the work of the people in that sense. Their job is to do the work of the people as a state agency. They are part of us. They're supposed to help us do our job and help us help them. They're not a quasi-state agency. They are a state agency. So this is our normal job as legislators of fine-tuning our own work in this governmental level.
Okay. Members, with that, I'm going to renew my motion that House File 1353 be laid over for possible inclusion in the state government finance omnibus bill. Members, Representative Johnson, you had some questions before we adjourn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just briefly, as we wind down our time here as the committee, can you give we, the minority, some idea of the schedule for the markup of the bill, and secondly, some idea for the best way we can provide input, and do you plan to seek our input prior to putting together a draft? So those three questions.
Sure, you bet. And Representative Johnson, your input is always welcome at any time. Any member that wishes to provide input to as we are putting this bill together. So if there are things that you have seen throughout the last couple of months that you have a keen interest in, if you haven't shared that within the committee process, feel free to share that with me in any way, shape, or form that you're most comfortable with. As far as like the markup of the bill, what my goal is that we'll come in a morning hearing. We will have the bill presented. That evening we'll meet. We will then go through the markup process, and then hopefully we'll be able to be completed within that time frame. So, and I hope to have the bill posted at least the night before, so that, well, it will be posted the night before, to give everybody time to go through it and review it before the committee hearing. So. Representative Johnson, any other questions?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So you thinking next week sometime, like Wednesday or something, or you have any idea?
You know what? I'm at the mercy of my leadership, so it depends upon when they tell me that they want things to go. So, yep.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Great. Representative Carl.
Madam Chair, a follow-up. You said the bill will be posted the night before. That would be the draft bill, and would the intent then be to also meet at a regular 10:15 time? I'm just concerned about the timeline if we should want to offer any amendments.
And that's why Representative Carlson, what we'll do is we'll have an evening session as well, realizing that you'll need some time to process it and go through it too. So same with us, we'll need some time to be able to go through it too. Members, I do want to give you a heads up. Monday, we're looking to hold a hearing on Monday to get some of these other bills that we have that we're looking to hear before we wrap things up as a committee and just to get time management and whatnot, because what we're seeing now is sessions are becoming longer and they're consuming more of our time, and I'm getting concerned about making sure that we have enough time before leadership tells us that we have to get something put together. So I want to make sure that we're not shortchanged in the end. So, and it won't be in the morning. We haven't settled on a time yet. At the earliest it'll be 11 on Monday, but no earlier than that. So, because I know some folks are traveling in from greater Minnesota, and I know that makes it sometimes difficult for them to come in. So 11 at the earliest, but maybe later than that on Monday. So we'll try and get that to you hopefully today. So with that, members, we are adjourned.